This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, we're going to look at a few old therapies that researchers are resurrecting as we run out of antibiotics to treat superbugs. But first, researchers have been trying to find ways to harness the power of the body's own immune system to fight cancer. And now one group of researchers may have made a step, an important step, toward a universal vaccine that would teach the body to fight any kind of cancer with the same tools that the body uses to fight viruses. Here to explain that development, plus other short subjects in science, is Sophie Bushwick, senior editor at Popular Science. Welcome to Science Friday.
I'm happy to be here.
Nice to have you. Walk us through the actual research findings. What was discovered?
So the researchers for a while have been trying to find ways to get the immune system to attack cancer, but the problem is that cancer cells are just too similar to the normal cells of the human body. So what these researchers did is they created nanoparticles from RNA. It's basically RNA enclosed in a little envelope made of fatty acids. And then they gave these nanoparticles a slight negative charge so they could steer them. And then they put them into the spleen and other lymphoid tissue in the body, where these nanoparticles targeted dendritic cells. Dendritic cells are kind of like the messengers of the immune system. And so they got these envelopes of RNA, and they thought that they were viruses. And so they primed the immune system to respond as if to a virus and to attack these tumors. So they so far have only tested it in models of mouse tumors and in three human patients with advanced melanoma, but they're saying that this technique really could be applied to a lot of other kinds of cancer.
So in phase one, it sounds like, for the patients.
That's right.
It was not toxic is what they're testing for then, and any hint that it might have actually helped or worked in those patients?
They did find it did prime the immune system to respond to the tumors.
This is exciting, using nanoparticle.
Yeah, that's right.
To create, writing in on a virus?
Right, the nanoparticles, the body thinks that these particles are viruses. They say, oh, it's here, this RNA, it's surrounded by some fatty acid. This is clearly a virus, we should attack it. And so it gets the immune system up and fighting.
Wow, that is interesting. Let's talk about astronauts on the International Space Station. And they are testing a potential habitat for camping out on other planets. This inflatable little, pod or something. We talked about this before. It was having trouble being inflated.
Yeah, last week they wanted to inflate it on Thursday. It's the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module, but BEAM for short.
Of course.
And apparently they think it might have been in storage for a little too long, which made the material kind of stiff. But over the weekend they did successfully inflate it. It's sort of this pod-shaped object, and when it's not inflated, it's about 7 feet long, and when they do inflate it, it almost doubles in length to 13 feet long, which gives you about 565 cubic feet of space to play around in. So they did inflate it, and now they're testing it for leaks, and the next step is going to have to be to have an astronaut actually go into the module and check it out. And then it's going to be on the space station for 2 years.
So 2 years?
2 years, yeah. They need to test it and make sure it can stand up to debris and to the crazy temperatures in space. And
it must be strong material.
It is. It's actually a fabric, but it's a proprietary material.
It's not plain Kevlar or something.
It's not Kevlar. You could compare it to that. It's kind of a similarly very sturdy material, and it's lots of layers of this fabric with air in between.
You know, if this proves to work, isn't this the kind of stuff you could build a habitat on Mars? Maybe Elon Musk wants some of this stuff to take with him to Mars.
Absolutely. You could put these habitats on the moon or on Mars for humans to live in, because they're very light. So for every cubic foot of space in BEAM, you've got about 5 pounds of weight. And compare that to the ISS, where for every cubic foot of space, it's about 30 pounds of weight. So this is so much lighter that it's a much more practical way. It's a much more practical habitat for people to take into space.
I had to tell you, you're not old enough to remember how radical an idea this is for NASA to build something that's inflatable anywhere. let's move on to your next topic, which is we learned this week that the opioid painkillers may not be good for pain killing in the long term.
Yeah, this is a kind of disturbing study. They looked at rats that were in pain, and they treated some of them with morphine for 5 days, and the other ones they didn't treat with drugs. And what they found was the ones that were treated took about 10 to 11 weeks to stop feeling pain from their injury, whereas the rats that weren't treated recovered in half the time, only 5 weeks. So what the researchers think was going on was that the immune system of the rats that were treated with morphine, their immune systems were attacking these opioids in the body, and that caused irritation that prolonged pain in the rats that were treated with morphine. But the good news is the researchers are saying that possibly you could prevent this effect from happening by suppressing that immune response.
What kind of pain was it? Where did it come from?
They pinched the sciatic nerve in the leg.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I know when that acts up, what that feels like.
And then in order to test how long the mice were in pain, they right. pinched their paws. And if they're still in pain from the sciatic nerve or from reaction to these opioids, then the rats were more likely to flinch.
Wow. And so I guess we'll be watching this because it has implications for humans.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, we're pretty much in what the FDA is calling an epidemic of substance abuse of opioids, whether it's heroin or prescription drugs, prescription mm-hmm. painkillers like Vicodin. There's a lot of addiction and a lot of issues with that.
Yeah. And finally, my favorite story of them all is the famous Dr. Henry Heimlich finally performed the Heimlich maneuver at the age of 96.
That's right. He says
he never did this before in his life.
He says he's never done it before. He says he's demonstrated it, uh-huh. you know, but never used it on someone who was choking. But he's 96. He's retired. He's living in a retirement home. And he says that he was at dinner and a woman began choking. And so he turned to her and performed the Heimlich maneuver and the food flew out of her mouth and she was saved. And it's pretty amazing that at the age of 96, he's finally getting to try his technique for the first time.
Yeah, and it's good that it all worked and everything turned out okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Sophie.
Thanks.
Interesting stuff. So Sophie Bushwick, senior editor at Popular Science. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. It won't come as a surprise to anyone when I say that the online world is full of ads. Hovering, covering, blinking, syncing, you got dancing ads, every kind and shape. And people are editing out these ads out of their online experience using something called ad blocking software. New numbers out from two companies, that's PageFair and Priority Data, say that 1 in 5 smartphone users block ads on their mobile devices. Joining me now to talk about the good and the bad is Will Aremus. He's senior technology writer at Slate. He's with me in our New York studios. Welcome back, Will.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Are there that many people really blocking ads when they go online?
Well, the specific numbers have been disputed a little bit. So the company that put out this study is actually in the business of selling solutions to media companies.
Why am I not surprised?
How to stop losing money on ad blocking. That said, the numbers that they had out there do line up pretty well with what I've seen anecdotally. A lot of people are blocking ads. Originally, people were doing it on their desktop computers. The news is that now they're doing it increasingly on their mobile phones. But that 1 in 5 figure, the mm-hmm. figure where 1 in 5 people are now blocking ads on their smartphones, that could be a little misleading depending on where you are. If you're in the United States, the figure is actually much, much lower. It's down around, I believe it's around 2% of U.S. smartphone users are blocking ads. If you're in India or Indonesia mm-hmm. Or Germany, actually, the number is significantly higher than 1 in 5. It's more like 2 in 5 in Germany and actually the majority in India and Indonesia.
Okay, so what's the good thing? Why are people so happy about it?
Can we flip this, Ira? Can we start with the bad thing?
You can take over. Go ahead.
Thank you.
The bad thing.
Thank you.
I
mean, this autonomy feels great. The bad thing is pretty obvious, I think. It's that if everybody did this, I would be personally out of a job. No, the bad
because
thing...
Because you need the ads?
Yeah, I mean, Slate is an ad-supported right. website. Most media is ad-supported. You know, some media companies have subscribers as well, but even they rely on advertising. You're safe, I think, Ira.
I'm safe. Why am I safe?
Well, you're not an ad-supported media business.
Well, we do have ads on our website. We do take ads.
Maybe you're not so safe after
we're
all.
We're not so safe. We may be not as guilty as though. We don't have all those ads. We can't afford to place them.
Well, good for you. But the issue is that this model that the media have relied on for a long time could really break if this number increases dramatically. If so many people are blocking these ads, then the websites have no way to get money out of their visits, and a lot of them will go out of business, and all that information that we want to be free will no longer be free.
Now, I would think that the good side, and now I'm going to reverse, and I'm going to tell you what I think the good side is.
Fair play.
Is you know, you're going to get ads, right? And they know how to curate them to only show you the ads that you want to see. Would that be considered a good thing instead of getting all the kinds of ads?
Yeah, so the good thing here, I mean, there's one really obvious and practical good thing, which is that the people who are using this software are having a really nice, smooth experience on their phones mm-hmm. without all these junky ads that you talked about. The other good thing, which you just alluded to, is a little more theoretical, and it's this idea that basically, websites have been bombarding people with these terrible ads because they can get away with them. And you don't have a choice. You go to a website and you get assaulted with these horrible
right.
ads. Now that people do have a choice, theoretically, it could incentivize media companies and advertisers to clean up their act and to start presenting ads that people actually want to see. I mean, if you think about the old model of the newspaper, there were ads in there. You know, you wanted to see the auto ads or the classifieds. There was stuff in there that you actually bought the paper partly to see. If you could make ads better in response to this, then I think that would certainly be a good thing. But there's a question of how do we get there from where we are today?
Is there something, a model maybe, I know in the gaming app world, there's a model called freemium. There's an ad, the app is free, but you pay for all kinds of add-ons in the game. Right, as you play the game, hey, I want to go to another level. You pay for that.
Yeah, so a freemium model is one possibility where maybe you get an ad-free version of a site if you're willing to pay for it. I don't personally put a lot of stock in that as the solution, because if you can block the ads for free, then why would you pay to block the ads?
Okay, you know, I don't have an answer. You'll have to come back. Well, thank you, Will. You've left us thinking about something this afternoon. Will Oremus is senior technology writer at Slate. Thanks for coming back again.
Thanks, Aaron.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, you know the expression, everything old is new again? Well, so it goes for antibiotics. Coming up, a few Back to the Future ideas which may help in the fight against superbugs, which are increasingly, you know, more of a problem. We're resurrecting some old ideas that are still very interesting ones, and we'll talk about them after the break. Stay with us. Last week, the U.S. Army announced the arrival of a new enemy on American soil. But the danger was microscopic, actually in the form of a bacterial gene, which confers resistance to one of our last-ditch antibiotics, colistin, and it can be easily transferred to other bacteria. Don't panic just yet, because the bacteria containing the gene weren't resistant to our entire arsenal of antibiotics. So the woman who harbored the bacteria recovered, and we're not out of options just quite yet. But the news was a reminder that we are not winning many battles against antibacterial resistance, and we certainly are not winning the war. There are, though, a few out-of-the-box ideas that could help us get there, and my next guest is investigating one of them himself. Brett Spellberg is a chief medical officer. He's chief medical officer at LAC-USC Medical Center in Los Angeles. He joins us by Skype. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me, Ira.
Well, Brett, you were alarmed, were you, by the news of this colistin-resistant gene?
Well, I wasn't probably as alarmed as some of the media reports would suggest. It's actually not new to have colistin resistance. We've had colistin resistance for a long time. The thing that's new is that the resistance is now in a very transmissible form that can spread much more easily than prior forms of resistance. And if it does spread to bacteria that are resistant to everything except colistin, will start to develop widespread pan-resistant organisms that can't be treated. That is alarming.
Hmm. Why are we running out of antibiotics?
Well, we aren't getting new ones developed at nearly the rate they used to be because the science is increasingly difficult, the economics is not favorable for a variety of reasons to do antibiotic discovery, and the regulatory environment has been very hostile to new antibiotic development. On top of that, resistance continues to spread because we continue to so badly abuse antibiotics and overuse them.
Mm-hmm. Right. The first part, if I understand in simpler terms, means that there's not a lot of money to be made by drug companies to make antibiotics.
That's certainly part of it. It's not the only part of it. I mean, the science is actually really hard because the stuff that's easy to discover has already been discovered. So it's getting increasingly difficult scientifically to discover the next new thing. And the regulations have really been very difficult to work with.
Mm-hmm. You've said that one of the problems is not just running out of the drugs, but the way they're administered, like the oral form doesn't work anymore versus the IV, which still works.
Well, we have organisms that are typically encountered in healthcare settings that could be resistant to pretty much everything. But this, what you're discussing is this much less well-appreciated looming problem that I think has not gotten enough attention, which is that we're now seeing community bacteria, not in healthcare settings, causing community onset infections, urinary tract infections, kidney infections, prostate infections, abdominal infections like diverticulitis and appendicitis. They're not resistant to everything. We have IV antibiotics left for them, but they're resistant to everything oral. Now, if you've got a urinary tract infection, do you want me to have to put you in the hospital for a week on IV antibiotics? Of course not. You want your oral Cipro and go home. But we're losing oral antibiotics for these patients. That's getting very alarming.
Well, and the answer to that might be?
Well, we need to do a much better job of protecting the antibiotics we currently have. We need to figure out how to get new antibiotics developed, and we need to think of new ways to treat infections that don't try to kill the bacteria. Resistance occurs because we apply selective pressure by trying to kill the bacteria so they emerge resistance. If we could treat infections without killing the bacteria directly, you might have a way to treat infections that's less prone to inducing resistance.
So what is the incentive for all of this new research that we need?
Well, that's been very widely debated for a long time. For typical antibiotics, there, I think we're going to be moving more and more over time towards a defense contractor model, away from a traditional pharma model, where the government, and there are agencies that are capable and funded to do this, and they're actually doing a very good job right now, can defray some of the upfront costs and risk to discover and develop a new antibiotic. On the back end, then, they get a say in which ones get developed, so we don't get a bunch of me-too drugs developed, but get drugs that we need to get developed and have a say in how the drugs will be priced downstream.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't the NIH do basic research?
NIH funds basic research. NIH also, as part of the Public Health Emergency Medical Countermeasures Enterprise, or FEMC, has established translational arms where they can help both academics and small companies do manufacturing and toxicity testing and phase one clinical trials to get drugs moved out of the laboratory and into patients, where they can then get passed on to an agency called BARDA, which is an HHS, that can fund phase two and phase three clinical trials to get those drugs into patients.
So what is it about? You mentioned the regulations that are tying up everything. What kinds of regulations?
The FDA has been very challenging in the antibiotic space for quite some time now, and they have made the conduct of clinical trials for new antibiotics very difficult, much larger than they used to be, and much more difficult to get patients enrolled in the trials. And that causes the trials to be more expensive, they take longer to enroll, and there are people that just look at it and say, well, I can't do that trial, I just don't think I can develop the drug.
I think we need to go back to loosening up some of that stuff.
Well, I don't like to use the word loosening because people think, oh, you're just trying to soften regulations. And I think the point is we definitely need regulations. The pharmaceutical industry has demonstrated without regulations, there are horrible abuses. But the regulations have to make sense. And so what we want is trials that are feasible to enroll in the United States of America. If you enroll a trial in Slovenia, which is where antibiotic trials are now enrolling in Eastern Europe, how do I know that has any relevance to taking care of patients in the United States?
Yeah. Yeah. You and others are researching something called antibody therapy, which actually harkens back to an old treatment for infection, right?
Yeah, it's ironic. 120, 130 years ago, some of the original Nobel laureates in microbiology, after they discovered that germs cause infections, began learning that the blood produces weapons to defeat those infections. And so they started to immunize horses with various types of infections, and they would bleed the horse, take the serum out of the horse blood, and they would infuse that serum into patients. It was called serum therapy. It was actually quite effective for diseases like diphtheria and pneumonia. It was also cumbersome. It had toxicities because you're using horse blood in humans. And it was so much more difficult and somewhat less effective when antibiotics came along. People just forgot about it and we abandoned it in the 1930s and 40s. We're now going back and learning that the primary thing in the blood that was working were these proteins called antibodies. And we have modern manufacturing methods. We can get very high purity, very high amounts of very specific antibodies to defeat microbes.
Wow. And how effective have we tried it yet? Is it working?
They are just now starting in the antibiotic space to get into clinical trials. It's what the irony is that because in fields like cancer and arthritis, there were not drugs as effective as antibiotics. Those investigators went to antibodies 20 years ago. We've had antibodies that are incredibly effective for cancer and arthritis and inflammatory bowel disease for 20 years. Because antibiotics have been so effective, we've only more recently gone back to our roots in the infectious disease world. Hmm. The lead molecule, the lead antibodies are just now entering clinical trials. And I think that the first ones to hit the market will probably be there in maybe 5 years or so.
Wow. I'd like to bring on another guest who's using viruses that attack bacteria called bacteriophages, or phages for short, to make resistant bugs sensitive to antibiotics again. And details appeared in the journal Scientific Reports last week. Paul Turner, professor and chair of the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Yale in New Haven. Welcome to Science Friday.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell us how this works. How do you make resistant bugs sensitive to the antibiotics again?
Right. So we are capitalizing on the classic idea of phage therapy, where this is an old idea that basically is gaining resurgence, where you use phages, which are bacteria-specific viruses, to target the bacteria instead of chemical antibiotics. So the trick is that phages, just like traditional antibiotics, the bacteria can gain resistance to them. So you have to use a strategy where you take the inevitability of evolution and you turn it in our favor in using the strategy. So that's what we did.
Because mm-hmm. this is old. I mean, didn't the Soviet Union sort of do a lot of work on this before World War II, before we had miracle drugs?
Yes. Interestingly, phage therapy dates back to near the discovery of phages, which is roughly 100 years ago. So the former wow. Soviet Union and Eastern Bloc nations like Poland have been using phage therapy and trying to develop it for as long or longer as the U.S. and Western nations have been developing traditional antibiotics.
And it actually worked, didn't it?
Yes, it worked actually remarkably well. Many things held it back. Amazingly, some of it is that the primary results were not published in English and also were never translated. So ironically, some of the classic, old, and very convincing studies have just never really been read by Western physicians. And now that we've run out of options, we're turning back to them.
Details. how about the human studies? How are they coming along?
All right, so there are clinical trials that show that phage therapy in humans is both safe and effective. And ideas like ours that are new twists on the old idea, we would love to bring these to clinical trials soon so we can make as many advancements as possible. So our particular idea is that if you find a phage that targets a bacterium, and the way that it is targeting it is to control the virulence factor, or the thing that the bacterium uses to cause disease, then you can actually exert selection pressure on the bacteria to either gain resistance to the phage and avoid it killing it, or they keep their antibiotic resistance. And what we found is that they can't do both at the same time. They're painted into a corner. So we throw the phages at them, and they must gain resistance. And at the same time, they simultaneously become more sensitive to antibiotics that are actually in our current drug arsenal. So it's a way of kind of keeping those around.
So they drop their guard in the first faint, and then you go in with the antibiotics.
That's true. They can't do both things simultaneously, so they cannot be a jack of all trades. Instead, we've found a way to turn old antibiotics that are continuing to be less and less efficacious and useful, and now we're able to to sort of use those still in combination with phages that exert the right kind of selection pressure.
Well, in your tests with humans, what kinds of tests have you been doing?
Well, so far we have approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to do what's kind of described as compassionate care. So unfortunately, there are very many individuals in the USA and elsewhere who have chronic bacterial infections where these bacteria are resistant to antibiotics and they really don't have any options left. Mm-hmm. So these individuals are very willing to undergo experimental therapy. And we got approval from the FDA to treat such individuals.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with research to combat those superbugs. Talking with Brad Spellberg and Paul Turner. Brad, what do you think of this? When we did stories about bad bugs in the past, it used to be all about MRSA or C. diff. It's not such a problem anymore.
Well, you know, C. diff is a problem. It's not an antibiotic resistance problem per se, but it's a side effect of antibiotic problem. It's still around. There are probiotics that are being developed for C. diff that I think will become the standard of care for C. diff in the next few years. MRSA is around. Actually, rates are declining across the United States and in many westernized countries for reasons we don't fully understand. The real problem, though, for MRSA is when it gets into the blood or bone. We actually have had a ton of drugs developed to treat MRSA in the skin and in the lung. That's no longer a huge antibiotic resistance problem.
Hmm. And what's your idea about Paul Turner's work with phages?
Well, I'm quite familiar with phages, and I think that they are certainly an interesting alternative opportunity that we need to really study. I think that they need to be subjected to highly rigorous randomized controlled trials. One of the reasons they fell out of favor in the United States, as Paul alluded to, is there were not randomized controlled trials done, at least for invasive infections. There were convincing trials done for like diarrheal illnesses, but for bloodstream infections or tissue infections, nobody had done the randomized controlled trial. Those are now being done, and I take my hat off to people like Paul that are pushing this technology forward. I think it is a promising alternative.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of disease, Paul, do you think will be tried first? What are you working on? What kind of illness?
Yeah, so currently we're focusing on multi-drug resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa, and that's because this is a very commonly encountered bacterium. It's in the human households. You see it in hospitals. And the point is it's very dangerous for people like cystic fibrosis patients, severe burn victims, immune-compromised individuals. So many of your listeners may not have heard of such infections, but they are very, very common. So the idea is that we found a phage that was effective in targeting multi-drug resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa, but we're also searching for phages that work in a very similar way against other targets, such as Klebsiella and pathogenic E. coli.
I think what's interesting, because we've talked about this over the years, we're now in our 25th year, and I've been following phages, is that the phage, which is a virus, there's a virus that will attack every bacteria, isn't there? I mean,
yes, it seems
nature
that,
has a way to evolve them.
That's right. So I have argued, and as many others have, that phages are actually the most numerous thing on the planet. So you can think of them as an almost endless pipeline for natural product discovery. If you go out and find a phage that has a useful application for many human problems that we suffer from, then I think we have many decades of promising research ahead to go find such phages and use them.
And even as the bacteria evolve, the phages evolve with them to attack them.
Yes, yes.
It's amazing.
They've been on the planet for billions of years alongside bacteria, so it's not surprising that they can wage war with each other very effectively, and we can hopefully capitalize on that.
Well, I'm wishing you the best of luck, because this is one of my pet subjects to follow over all of these years. Paul Turner.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Paul Turner, professor and chair of the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Yale University in New Haven. Thanks for joining us. We're going to have more on antibiotic resistance. Stay with us. We're going to talk more about antibiotics and how they travel through the feedlots, the waterways, and even vegetables, how they get into our systems just about everywhere, how they show up in your food, how they show up in, well, we'll talk about it. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. Antibiotic resistance is our topic this hour with my guest, Brad Spellberg, Chief Medical Officer at LACPLUS USC Medical Center in Los Angeles. I'd like to turn now to the issue of antibiotics and your burrito. I'm talking about the antibiotics, of course, used in livestock, either to prevent and treat infection or to simply fatten the animals up. Felicia Wu is the John A. Hanna Distinguished Professor in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're quite welcome, Dr. Wu. How does our use of antibiotics in agriculture compare to the amount we use, let's say, in clinical settings?
Well, the total amount of antibiotics used in animal agriculture is quite large. I think perhaps a more relevant question is, what is the contribution of the use of antibiotics in animal culture versus in human medicine to the problem of antibiotic resistance that we see today? And that is not a question that we really know how to answer yet.
Why do you say that?
Well, there's many different... So sometimes... when we do encounter a case of antibiotic resistance, it's very difficult to state exactly how it was that the bacteria that caused the infection acquired resistance in the first place. There's actually a fairly large number of different pathways by which bacteria could have developed resistance. They could have developed it in the environment, which is one of the areas that I'm interested in working in. They could have developed it in through clinical routes, through medical routes, many different routes.
Mm-hmm. Brad Spellberg, the idea that agricultural use could lead to more resistant bugs in healthcare settings, does that ring a bell with you? Oh.
I don't even want to call it a debate. This has been a discussion that's been going on for years. To answer your question, Ira, four times as many antibiotics are purchased for use in livestock as for use in human beings in the United States. It is true that we cannot say definitively what proportion of resistant infections in humans is attributable to the use of antibiotics in animals. But we can say there is a contribution. And so societally, rather than getting into a debate on the minutia of exactly what proportion of this causes that, the point really is, since we know it contributes, and that's a serious societal negative or con, what is the pro that it offers society that should allow us to want to put up with that con? And the pro really is that the people who use antibiotics in livestock believe that it allows them to make more money. So one group in society believes it can make more money by putting antibiotics into livestock, which does create a risk of harm to other people in society. Why our society chooses to tolerate that remains unclear to me.
Felicia, would you agree with that?
So those are interesting points as to the question. Yes, there certainly is. There are a number of economic reasons that animal producers do wish to use antibiotics in animal feed, and I'm going to go over the three main reasons. One is for disease treatment, infectious disease treatment, to treat animals with infectious diseases just as with humans. The second is for
Is that before or after they get the disease? Is that prophylactic, in other words?
Well, so therapeutic use of antibiotics in animal operations can be both prophylactic as well as after the fact. And so those are two reasons to use it, for disease treatment and disease prevention. And in addition, thus far, antibiotics in animal agriculture have also been used for growth promotion. In order for the animals to grow more quickly, in order for them to be able to utilize their feed more efficiently and thereby able to produce larger animals more quickly to create more profit.
Mm-hmm. And when I read the fine print on the, quote, antibiotic-free meat, it says they're not given antibiotics for growth, but that doesn't mean they're not getting a bunch of antibiotics for other things.
Exactly. And that is the way that the FDA policies on antibiotics used in animal feed have been going as well, that essentially through the FDA Final Guidance 209 and 213, as well as their Veterinary Feed Directive, or VFD, final rule, the idea behind these policies is that antibiotics that are important for human medical uses will be phased out for use in animal agriculture in terms of for the specific use of growth promotion and feed efficiency. They can still be used for therapeutic purposes, but that would be specifically under the supervision of licensed veterinarians.
Mm-hmm. Brad, what do you make of this argument by farmers? If they're not allowed to use antibiotics to fatten up their animals, they won't be able to compete economically with farmers abroad.
Yeah, so there's multiple points that need to be made. Prophylaxis is not therapeutic. Nobody is arguing with the desire to treat sick animals. That's perfectly legitimate use of an antibiotic. What is happening is people have finally begun to intellectually attack the concept of growth promotion is people are just changing the name. And they're saying, oh, well, it's not growth promotion, that's prophylaxis. Prophylaxis in almost no setting is acceptable in humans. In almost no setting should it be acceptable in animals. There are a few settings where there is an incredibly high short-term risk of infection where it makes sense. But so the answer to your most recent question, Ira, is that there have been multiple countries that have already banned growth promotion and routine prophylactic use of antibiotics. And not only have their farmers not been harmed economically, they have expanded their herds after the ban. And recent economic analyses are really suggesting that the historical growth promotional benefits of antibiotics may no longer be that economically impactful. We may be overestimating even the economic benefit to the farmers. But I want to go back to this point. Should we as a society decide that a small economic advantage to a small group of people in our society is a reason we should accept creating a risk of harm to everyone else in the society? Does that make sense from a societal policy perspective?
Felicia, I'm pushing that question in your direction.
Well, the advantage is, as Dr. Spellberg pointed out, it's not entirely clear because these FDA policies will not come into effect for over about another half a year. These are going to come into effect in the beginning of 2017, end of this year. So it's entirely possible that we may find, as in the case with other countries, that the use of these antibiotics for therapeutic purposes and not for growth promotion may not have as much of a potential impact on the competitiveness of our animal product markets as some may suspect. We don't know that for a fact yet. There are many people who are concerned about what would happen if, for example, we follow these particular policies. Does that mean that we're going to be less competitive on the global market for meat? There is that concern, but there are many companies, many food chains, for example, that are moving forward with purchases of antibiotic-free meat. These include Chipotle, Panera, Dunkin' Donuts, and McDonald's, for example, in the purchase of antibiotic-free chicken.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the phones. Our number, if you'd like to call in, 844-724-8255. Let's go out to Kansas. Hutch, Kansas. Ben, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you?
Hey there.
Yes, I was listening, and the gentleman speaker, he made the comment, I am a farmer in a cow herd in here in Kansas, and yes, it's true that we do use and try to grow more beef by antibiotics and hormones and all that, but at the same token, with a booming population in the world, isn't the fact that we can produce more meat for people in the world got a value that is more than the dollar?
Brad, how would you answer that?
Well, you know, I'm going to go back to countries that have banned routine growth promotion and routine prophylaxis have not seen declines in their herds. Denmark had a marked expansion in its pig production, for example, after they did the ban. There are other ways to feed people, and C, there are harms. There are harms. And when patients die of resistant infections, and we can say, well, I don't know what proportion of those infections are caused by routine use of antibiotics. But when 80% of our antibiotic use is in livestock, we have to acknowledge that we're saying it's okay that we know people will be harmed because we don't know how many and because some people are making money off it. To me, that equation does not add up.
Ben in Kansas, do you have no market for Felicia was talking about Chipotle, McDonald's, other meat users now going to antibiotic-free food. Do you have no market for people like that?
Oh, I have. I mean, there's a way to get a market for that, and you know, we have access to quite a few markets like that. And on our herd, we don't. I mean, it's not just a shotgun approach where every animal gets treated. I mean, you know, we keep animal health in our mind as much as our family's health, to where, you know, it's treat an animal when it needs to be treated and not otherwise, because those antibiotics aren't free, and we are out here to make money, so we do, you know, we do consider costs that go into that animal versus costs that come out of that animal. And so it's not just a shotgun approach that the whole industry is that way, that I think gets kind of lumped together.
And Ben, I think that's an important point, because again, nobody's criticizing you for treating sick animals. Sick animals need to be treated. It sounds like you may not be using routine growth promotion or routine prophylaxis, which is more of a shotgun approach.
All right. Thanks for cluing us in, Ben. Good luck out in Kansas.
Good show.
Thank you. Felicia, can antibiotics actually get into the flesh of an animal raised on antibiotic feed? Can we eat that? Is it still active as an antibiotic?
Thankfully, that is not a problem in the meat that we purchase in the United States. There's actually a policy by which whenever a pharmaceutical company is going through the approval process for an antibiotic to be used in animal feed with the FDA, they have to demonstrate to the FDA that there's no antibiotic residue that remains in the meat or other parts of the animal like the liver or other specific tissues for a certain period of time, which is called a withdrawal period. And in that withdrawal period, if the antibiotic residue was still in the animal, then that animal cannot be taken to market. Mm-hmm. If it is taken to market within that period of time and there is the antibiotic residue, then the producer actually faces a potential penalty.
Myra Flato, this is... Wait, I'll just jump in for a second. Myra Flato, this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about the hot topic of antibiotic resistance. Did you want to jump in there, Brad?
Yes, sorry, Ira. I just wanted to clarify. I think the real concern is not so much that there's residual antibiotics in the meat. The concern is that during the butchering process, there is almost invariably some degree of contamination of bacteria in the meat. And those bacteria were exposed to antibiotics and therefore are often antibiotic resistant. So the concern is transmission of antibiotic resistant bacteria from the meat, from the excrement of the animals, which is used to fertilize crops, which can get into groundwater, which has been shown possibly even to be spread in airborne ways. So it's more the spread of bacteria that are bred to be resistant by exposure to the antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Wu, go ahead.
I think that that's a very interesting point, Dr. Spellberg. My area is in risk assessment, and our group is interested in that this problem actually has three different things that we should really be concerned about. One is the antibiotics. The second, as you mentioned, is the antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And the third is antibiotic-resistance genes and how they might spread in the environment and how we might be exposed to them through various different routes and pathways of exposure. Each of these problems has to be treated a bit differently, actually, for the examples that you raise. Are we really concerned if there are antibiotics in the meat? Well, that isn't really a problem here in the States, but what about antibiotic-resistant bacteria? What about the genes? What's the likelihood that if we accidentally consume these antibiotic-resistant bacteria, that other bacteria in our gut might acquire resistance? These are all interesting risk assessment questions, and these are actually fairly separate risk assessment problems.
Can they, Dr. Wu, get into our fruits and vegetables?
Certainly.
The bacteria
Okay. Yes, that's... So several studies have shown that indeed if there are antibiotics in the environment, if they are in irrigated water, then certain crops can take up the antibiotics. A recent study showed, for example, that carrots and lettuce can actually take up both tetracycline and amoxicillin if it's in the irrigated water. So that is another potential source of exposure to antibiotics inadvertently through produce.
Are they still viable when we eat them?
It's a good question. They may possibly be viable. The question has to do with the dose. So are these doses likely to have effects of killing bacteria? We don't really know. And are they at doses that may put pressure on bacteria to lead to resistance, that's another thing that we do not know yet.
Mm-hmm. I understand you mentioned before that they can even get into the air, the antibiotics?
Yes, that's correct.
How do they do that? We could be breathing them in?
Well, there was a very interesting study that just came out last year that studied the how particulate matter in the air can actually transport the antibiotics, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and antibiotic-resistance genes through wind dispersal. So this study showed that within roughly 10 to 20 meters from cattle feed yards, if they were to take samples of the air and find the particulate matter, there they would also find the antibiotic resistance genes, the bacteria, and the antibiotics themselves.
Another way to spread them. Wow.
Yes.
Wow. I have nowhere to go after that. That's just mind-blowing enough. Felicia Wu, John A. Hanif, Distinguished Professor in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Brad Spellberg, Chief Medical Officer at the LAC Plus USC Medical Center in Los Angeles. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you very much.
It's almost time for Cephalopod Week, and Science Friday is teaming up with the New York Obscura Society to host our first ever Cephalopod Movie Night. Yes, you love the trivia contest? Now we have the movie night. It's on June 20th, 7 p.m. at the Sea Witch Tavern in Brooklyn. We're going to be screening two brand new Cephalopod movies, along with one classic video from the Sci-Fi Vault. So that's, let me repeat that, Cephalopod Week, New York Obscura Society. The date you got to know is June 20th, 7 p.m. at the Sea Witch Tavern in Brooklyn, screening two brand new Cephalopod videos, along with one classic video from a Sci-Fi Vault. And you want to come by before the tickets are all snapped up. Go to sciencefriday.com/movie night. Hope to see you all there. Charles Berquist is our director, senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Luke Groskin, our video producer, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.